To Truth Jihad Radio. I'm your host, Kevin Derrick. I'm on here at We the People Radio Network every weekend, 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time. Tomorrow's going to be an exciting show because I don't have my guests lined up yet. But today we have a terrific guest. And to lead into introducing him, let me say that the debate over 9/11 has been a very interesting one in that the people who've defended the official story keep shifting the ground under our feet. This has been going on from the very beginning, at least the beginning of when I got involved in this. I remember back in late 2003, early 2004, when I explained to people that, there are these 10 exclusive characteristics of controlled demolition and things like that, free fall speed, complete collapse, and so on and so forth, people would say, but there aren't any engineers who say that. Well, you know, pretty soon along came some engineers, and then the ground shifted, and they say, these people are just conspiracy theorists and so on, and they've never published in any mainstream scientific journals. Well, first, of course, it was they've never published at all, and then the Journal of 9/11 Studies appeared with a lot of great articles, and then they said, well, they never publish in mainstream scientific journals. And, in the last less than a year, we've had two publications in mainstream scientific journals. Now, of course, the ground has shifted once again. When I let Noam Chomsky know this, he responded that, he wasn't qualified to judge this debate. I said, wait a minute. You know, Mr. Chomsky, I think you're probably a little smarter than I am. And it didn't take me that long to understand this article, 10 Points of Agreement with the Official Government Reports on the World Trade Center. I'm sure you're capable of it. But, it's one thing to be capable of understanding something, and it's another thing entirely to be willing to understand it, to want to understand it, to even be open to understanding it. And that's the situation we're in. The people on the other side of the debate won't debate because they're just not even open to understanding what's at stake in the debate. They're not open to understanding the evidence that's being discussed. That's why there aren't any real debates on this topic. The other side has folded up its tent and refused to come out. Well, and part of that, we're winning now. We're winning this discussion among informed people. And my guest today, Kevin Ryan, is one of the people who are most responsible for this fact. Kevin Ryan is a former site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories at Underwriters Laboratories. He was fired shortly after he wrote a letter to a NIST scientist pointing out that the NIST report on the causes of the building collapses were completely inconsistent, and he asked for some clarifications based on what he knew had gone on at Underwriters. Those clarifications were never forthcoming, and Kevin Ryan was fired for having the temerity to ask a few questions. Don't tase me, bro. I'm just trying to ask a few questions. Since then, Kevin Ryan has been one of the most effective people working to get the truth out about 9/11. He is a co-author of the two recent mainstream scientific journal publications on the subject, 14 Points of Agreement with the Official Government Report, a wonderful piece by Kevin Ryan along with Stephen Jones, Frank Legge, Tony Zambodi, and James Gurley. And then his most recent mainstream publication, along with Ryan Jones Gurley, is called Environmental Anomalies at the WTC, Evidence for Energetic Materials. So Kevin Ryan is breaking new ground in the scientific study of 9/11 and in getting the truth out about that horrible event. And he's also one of the most, one of the most cool people I've met in the 9/11 truth movement, a genuinely spiritual, caring, decent, and commonsensical person. So hey, it's a real pleasure to welcome my good friend Kevin Ryan to Truth Jihad Radio. How you doing, Kevin?
Hey, thanks for that great introduction, Kevin. It's good to be with you.
Well, you know, there are some of us out there who appreciate your hard work and sacrifice. I know it feels to put your job in jeopardy, and I really admire the way you've lived with your convictions over these past few years.
Yeah, you and I and Stephen Jones are part of a growing, but I think somewhat honorable club of people who have lost our jobs for, as you said, asking questions about the official conspiracy theory and demanding some answers ultimately. And so we're not going to give up, of course, until we get those answers. And so I appreciate your work as well. Of course, I've always been a great admirer of yours, Kevin, and I'm glad to be on your show.
Well, it's great to have you back. And especially this, I don't think I've had you here since these latest publications have come out, your Journal of 9/11 Studies article, the top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermite is pretty amazing. And then those two mainstream scientific journal publications are real accomplishments. So I figure we could probably fill out the 2 hours and a whole lot more talking about that, these breakthroughs that you've been a part of.
That sounds great to me. The first paper in the mainstream arena was the 14 points of agreement with official reports, and that was a paper that the first author is Stephen Jones, who's just a great scientist and a wonderful person. And I think most of your listeners probably know Stephen, a little bit about Stephen.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I've had him on several times, and I have never made any secret of my admiration for him.
Yeah, and he is, of course, brilliant in his approach, which at first is clearly he's a Christian man. So he's at all times he's trying to give people the benefit of the doubt and turn the other cheek, right, and say, okay, we've heard all these things from you government scientists, and so what we're going to try to do is begin with what we agree with and go through those. It turned out to be 14 major points of agreement. And, of course, but at the same time, that highlights where we differ. So it's a very interesting and intelligent approach that Stephen came up with, and the other four of us as co-authors helped him kind of flesh that out.
So that was Stephen's idea to come up with these points of agreement and use that as a way of sort of prying them loose from their own official story.
Absolutely, because once you admit some of the things that the government scientists have already admitted, then you're left with many more questions. For example, they admit that the buildings fell essentially at free fall speed, the towers. So if you do a kind of a back calculation with what NIST suggests for the fall times, both buildings fall from the top to the ground would be 12 seconds, and that is essentially free fall speed within just a couple of seconds. So, of course, we ask, if that's the case, how could the upper section of the building possibly fall through the cold 70 to 90 stories of existing structure that held up the building for 30 years as if there was nothing there, you know, as if it was just somebody dropped a baseball from the top of the building, and it fell straight through the building as if the building wasn't there.
And nobody seems to be able to explain that. Even NIST itself never explained that. All they explained was the loss of vertical support on a couple of floors. But that doesn't explain how the top part would have come right down through the whole bottom part at the same speed it would fall through thin air.
That's exactly right. And the one of the laws of physics that the idea violates, of course, assuming that, as government scientists do, that there were no explosives, one of the laws it violates is the conservation of the momentum, which means that the upper section, as it falls, will collide with and exchange energy with the stationary section, and that's going to cause some hesitation. So there's going to be some transfer of momentum. It's going to take some time, and ultimately some engineers have already proven that the upper section would come to rest fairly quickly. Those include Scottish engineer Gordon Ross, and his paper is published at the Journal of 9/11 Studies.
Well, that's right. I remember I actually got involved in that a little bit when I think Gordon Ross had some back and forth with what's his name? I just had him on the show a month ago, the Canadian guy. I'll remember his name in a second, but he was Greening, Frank Greening. Right. At that time, he was kind of the only apparently independent defender of the government. And I remember giving offering the Galileo Award to Gordon Ross for his very amusing performance in this debate with Frank Greening.
I remember that, yeah. And you've always got away with the humor, bringing in the humor, which I think lightens things up and helps a bit. As far as these 14 points go, there are a number of very strong statements in that paper, and I think people should read that if they haven't, and forward it on to people who still are thinking there may be some value to the government's position, because that paper really breaks that down. And, we agree with them that they ultimately tell us that they just simply can't provide a full explanation for how the buildings, quote, collapsed. And we agree with that, of course. We have submitted a request for correction, several of us, including my co-authors Stephen Jones and James Gorley, along with architect Richard Gage and a number of the 9/11 families. We've submitted a request to NIST to formally challenge their report, and they did respond to that last year, and we submitted an appeal to their response, which is their response was essentially just poo-pooing everything that we said, everything that we brought up, the problems with their report. And actually, when they responded to us, their position became even worse. And so I think our appeal is a very strong statement in itself, and you can find that appeal in the original complaint at the Journal of 9/11 Studies. It's been referenced before by David Ray Griffin and others. But anyway, going back to the 14 points paper, there's clear evidence of molten metal at the World Trade Center. And despite the fact that NIST's John Gross has been recorded, videotaped as saying he has seen no evidence of molten metal, there's quite a bit of, even from the official side of the story, people supporting the official side of the story have openly admitted there's been molten metal at the World Trade Center in the rubble piles, and of course we saw it pouring from the building, the South Tower. So that's one of the points that we kind of flesh out in the paper and say we agree with this, but we also agree, hopefully you agree, NIST, that there has been no explanation for that. So that's kind of an important point. Molten metal.
That was one of the things. Yeah, that was one of the things that Stephen Jones first noticed when he suddenly got suspicious about the whole case in the first place was there's molten metal here. Where did that come from?
Right. So where did it come from? And Stephen Jones hypothesized that it came from the thermite reaction. And when he was given samples of slag from some columns at the World Trade Center, actual samples from steel columns at the World Trade Center, as well as dust samples from independent collectors, he was able to verify that the presence, that the thermite reaction, which is a reaction between aluminum powder and iron oxide. It's a very exothermic reaction, causes a great deal of heat, and one of the products is molten iron. He was able to prove that the slag samples and these microspheres in the dust that he found matched exactly with products of the thermite reaction. Actually, he ended up modifying it, calling it the thermite reaction, which I know you've been familiar with and have mentioned already on this show. Thermite being the thermite reaction with sulfur added.
Right.
And so his explanation seems to cover the evidence fairly well, whereas the only kind of vague half answers NIST has given is, well, either the aluminum from the plane somehow pooled in the corner of the building and then it was heated to the right temperature and waited until such a time to pour out of the corner of the south tower, that one corner. Or, for example, in the rubble piles, NIST suggests that maybe long, intense fires in the rubble piles could have caused molten metal. Neither of those explanations are very good. And the reason for the aluminum not being very good is because aluminum looks silvery when it's poured in the daylight, and the metal pouring out of the building is clearly yellowish-orangish color, like molten steel or molten iron.
Now, well, wasn't there also an attempt to claim that there were some batteries on that floor and it could have been lead from the batteries or something like that?
Yeah, but I believe lead is also a grayish color when it's pouring. So,
right.
But I'd be happy to look at that if anybody's got it written up.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment with some more talk about Kevin Ryan's breakthrough scientific report on the destruction of the World Trade Center. Stick around.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Jihad Radio Show. I'm Kevin Barrett. Today I'm talking with Kevin Ryan. He's a co-author of a couple of mainstream scientific journal articles concerning the apparent controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. We're talking right now about the first of these, 14 points of agreement with the official government report. And we were just talking about the fact that there was all sorts of evidence of molten metal produced by the destruction of the World Trade Center towers, and yet there's no explanation for that. And it's funny, Kevin, when we were first told what might have happened to the World Trade Center on and shortly after 9/11, there were all sorts of reports that the planes exploded with these massive fireballs, and it was just too intense, and it melted the steel. So we got this melted steel stuff drilled into our heads right away, and it was only later that people noticed, wait a minute, fossil fuel fires can't melt steel, so what happened? And they still won't, face that contradiction.
Yeah, absolutely. The molten metal is really an Achilles heel for the government, and they have come out recently in the last couple of years and said that they admit that the steel actually couldn't have melted from the fires. In fact, they changed their stance about softening of the steel as well. That's part of what I questioned them for back in 2004. And they changed that and said that the steel had simply been weakened. And sometimes jokingly suggest that if I had to write another letter, they would change the report and say that the steel was somehow spiritually defeated, but in any case, the fact is that there was a great deal of molten metal. So it's kind of a sticky wicket for them. So they'll go ahead and they'll admit there's no melted steel from the fires. And then, of course, we show them all this evidence for molten metal, including some of the researchers who had first access to the site. There's an Iranian engineer by the name of Astane Asol. Is that how you pronounce it, Kevin?
It sounds close enough to me. I don't speak Persian, but
okay, Astane. Well, I would ask a professor of languages before I would just venture a guess. But I've communicated with him myself, and he unfortunately says he's too busy to look into these things nowadays. But back even last year when he was investigating a bridge collapse in California, he mentioned to the press, and it was published, that he saw melted girders at the World Trade Center. And this guy was the first one to have access to the steel at Ground Zero, even before FEMA did.
And how did he get there so fast?
Well, he was working on a National Science Foundation grant, and somehow, I think he's probably just nice to the people who were guarding the area, and somehow got in. And he saw and published this. He saw steel columns that had huge holes in them, just inexplicable, just these big holes. And this gets again to the one of the other points of our paper, the sulfidation of steel samples that were found by some of the researchers, and FEMA had an Appendix C in their report. This is important now because of BBC's recent semi-hit piece. But they said back then that these steel samples that had evidence of a high-temperature corrosive reaction with sulfidation and oxidation of the steel, and that there was clearly a eutectic mixture going on in this steel. So some high concentrations of sulfur had gotten into the grains of the steel, the microstructure of the steel, and they couldn't explain it. They came out 8 months is when the eight months after 9/11 is when the FEMA report came out, and they said that we simply can't explain this. There's no indication of how this could have happened. And the reason I mentioned BBC is these same guys came out just a month or so ago. Despite having said in their first report in May of 2002 there was no explanation and it would require detailed study to try and figure out, you know, whether office fires would suddenly just liquefy all the steel in a building and cause these huge holes and Swiss cheese-like appearance of the steel, ribbon-thin-like steel pieces. So they needed to make a detailed study, but they didn't do any kind of detailed study. What they did is, 6 years later, they appeared on BBC's show with their conspiracy files presentation. And these professors, Sisson and Burnett, from Worcester Polytechnic Institute, simply said, well, it's no longer a mystery. We've kind of thought about it, and it must have been the sulfates from the wallboard contributed to some extreme mixture of, you know, in the rubble piles and caused this sulfidation and this incredible thinning of the steel. It's very deceptive the way they brought it up. They actually brought out some of the samples that they showed in their original report, but to me it looked clearly they actually cut off the ribbon thin parts of the steel and walked around and presented this chunk that kind of looked like a brick of steel. And then they completely reversed their position, saying, that's no mystery at all. The sulfidation must have been from, you know, sulfates in the wallboard.
Right. So every time there's a fire someplace with wallboard, the steel in the structure is going to turn to Swiss cheese and melt.
Right. It's absurd. It's absurd to begin with anyway, Kevin, because it's the wallboard, of course, that provides the fireproofing for the steel. It's ridiculous.
So if you want to do a controlled demolition of a skyscraper, all you really have to do is make sure that there's some wallboard in there and start a fire.
I guess so. And World Trade Center 7 has still not been fully explained. Of course, the official report is supposedly due out this month. And that's, of course, course, not surprising, because what I expect is they'll release a report just before 9/11 while people are barely paying attention again. And, you know, people like the independent investigators like myself will not have a chance to even read the report before it's published. Whatever they have to say is published around the world as stated fact. In any case, we expect a report out here in a couple of weeks on World Trade Center 7. We expect it to be quite different from what they've been saying to date, which was that there were fires in the building after the supposedly extensive damage from the fall of the North Tower. There were extensive fires as well. Those two things in themselves are pretty low probabilities, because the two buildings on either side of World Trade Center 7, which were equidistant from the North Tower, had no damage, right, and no fires. It's just this one happened to be owned by the same person who leased the towers.
Right. Yeah. Any building owned by Silverstein was having really bad luck that day.
Very bad luck. All of a sudden, this one building had a huge amount of damage. And then they were saying some time ago that there were diesel fuel tanks in the building that caused a migration of fuel from the west side of the building over to the east side of the building. It was very hard for them to explain, but they were trying to pin the fires on the diesel fuel. But the noise they've been making lately is becoming clear that they're not going to use diesel fuel as part of the story ultimately at all.
So it's basically an office fire has caused the controlled demolition theory.
Office fire on fireproof steel. Yeah, it's just any building in the world could now suddenly collapse.
Tomorrow morning, every tall building will just collapse from a couple of small fires. We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Kevin Ryan.
Great host, great topics, brief speech at its best. This is We the People Radio Network.
Back to Truth Jihad Radio, right here at We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Kevin Ryan today. He's the co-author of two recent mainstream scientific peer-reviewed journal articles on the apparent controlled demolition of the World Trade Center. And he's also written for the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which is better than any mainstream journal. A recent article there is Top 10 Connections Between NIST and Nanothermites. If you do want to talk to Kevin, the number here is 512-646-1984. Kevin, yeah, we were talking about this impending release of the NIST report on Building 7, which is years and years overdue. And you're saying that they're basically blaming it on office fires. It wasn't the diesel tanks. And as I understand it, the damage, they're not saying that the damage had much to do with it either.
That's what it sounds like, and of course, I think they're having to come up with this really, really weak and transparently false explanation, because it's just too difficult to explain how the diesel fuel could have been part of something that caused the east side of the building, essentially the northeast side of the building, to fail. Just due to the actual damage and the location of the potential damage that we do think might have existed. Not very much, but some on the southwest corner, so the exact opposite of the building. We're gonna see a report that's just, I think, transparently false, and we're not going to have any time to respond to it, because they're going to, it appears, release it just before the anniversary this year.
Right. So they get all the publicity with the pre-anniversary media, and by the time it gets read and responded to, it'll be after 9/11, and, oh, well, we'll wait and, you know, talk about that next year.
Right. Well, we may see a lot of changes nationally in the next year, but we'll just have to see. If you want to talk about this top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermites, I think that's very compelling information. It's published at the Journal of 9/11 Studies, as you said. It's not in a mainstream journal, but I can tell you that the papers at the Journal of 9/11 Studies undergo an intensive peer review, and every bit as intensive as mainstream journals. Now that we have a couple of papers in mainstream journals, we can certainly make that comparison and state that fact. But the basic point of the top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermites is that as NIST was trying to explain these fires that could not be put out at Ground Zero, and these fires that lasted much longer in the towers than they possibly could have due to just the office furnishings, the NIST even admits this in their most recent advisory team meeting minutes, and you go to their website and you pull up the December 18th, 2007 meeting minutes, and they come right out and say, well, at any given location in either any of the three buildings, the fuel load only supplied about 20 minutes worth of fuel for the fire. So that doesn't mean, as Cheyenne Sunder said, that doesn't mean the fire was out after 20 minutes. It moved around. But in any given location, it could have only burned for 20 minutes. And we saw in the North Tower fires raging opposite the wall of impact an hour and 20 minutes, after the plane's impact. So clearly there's some other kind of combustion going on there. And one very possible explanation relates to the thermite reaction or with more of an explosive effect, what are called nanothermites. And nanothermites are materials where the aluminum and the iron oxide or other metal oxide is mixed on the nanometer scale. So nano-sized materials, nanopowders are mixed together and actually mixed in solution. I can tell you now that I've made some of this material, Kevin, and it's very interesting stuff. I've ignited this stuff, and of course, this is all part of the ongoing investigation and the much more interesting papers that are to come in comparing these materials to what we're finding in the World Trade Center dust. So wow. Much more to come, and I think you'll be excited about that when it does come out.
Boy, there's so much coming out on this front, and you know, at some point, I think we're going to have proof that's so far beyond overwhelming that you just wonder what the other side is going to have to say about it. But
really, I mean, just the complete falsity of the official stories, and I'm not just talking about the most recent one, but as you suggested earlier, we went through a whole string of false stories. You know, the melted steel, the column failure theory that Silverstein's insurance claim came up with, the pancake theory that lasted for years and then was abandoned, and now this pile driver theory that NIST can't seem to make work, even with access to all the evidence and all the major media, they still can't make it work. But what we are seeing now is it's very possible are these explosive nanothermites as a possibility.
It does look like the evidence is starting to kind of converge on these nanothermites. I understand that these have been developed at places like Lawrence Livermore Lab, and they're a part of a military research program.
Right, and so they have quite a few papers, and if you go through the references in my paper, you'll find some of those. But Lawrence Livermore is a very interesting place that makes weapons for the government and in this case, these nano-explosives. And they are one of the laboratories that's managed by an overseeing group also called Battelle. And Battelle is interesting for many reasons. Battelle is the company that managed the Fort Detrick lab where the anthrax was made. They also had people involved in their organization like Arden Bemitz, who just happened to be the person directed to lead the NIST investigation just a month after September 11th.
What was that name again, Kevin?
Arden Bemitz was the director nominated by George W. Bush in October 2001. He became director of NIST in December 2001 and ended up being the leader of the NIST investigation until 2004, when another director took over. His name is Samarjian, Harach Samarjian. Samarjian has very close links to the man who's probably the most prominent nanothermite scientist in the world, Michael Zachariah. So these guys have really interesting connections to the things that happened on 9/11, the likely technologies, and I think ultimately the people who had access to the buildings. So I try to make some of those connections in this paper and make them...
That's fascinating, and it's kind of absurd in a way that that NIST did all this massive investigation and didn't even consider the possibility of thermite or thermate, and yet all of these top NIST people are involved in advanced research on these very substances that they're pretending to ignore.
It really is exactly that absurd. I mean, and that's what I'm trying to point out with this paper. Another example is Foreman Williams, who is the lead engineer on the NIST Advisory Committee, and he was the most prominent engineer in the popular mechanics book, Foreman Williams. So they just called him a professor from the University of California, San Diego, but he was, in fact, the lead engineer on the NIST Advisory Team, and he also is an expert on energetic materials and the ignition of porous energetic materials. And that's exactly what we're talking about with nanothermites, porous energetic materials. So, you know, it goes on from there to this company called the Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, who has just this extensive history with giving us the story for what happened in the 1993 bombing. They were the largest contributor to the NIST report outside of government scientists. And they develop and formulate nanothermites directly. So
amazing. And in all of their work on trying to explain what happened, they're looking everywhere but nanothermites.
Right.
We'll be back in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett talking with scientist Kevin Ryan about the destruction of the World Trade Center. We'll be right back. Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. Today I'm talking with Kevin Ryan, the Underwriters Labs whistleblower who has been doing fantastic work in tracking down the criminals who blew up the World Trade Center. And it does appear that the evidence is starting to converge, indicating the use of some form of nanothermites. And one part of that evidence is this amazing set of connections between key people in the cover-up and advanced research in these very substances that they pointedly ignore in all of their reports on what happened to the Trade Center. And, Kevin, you point out in your article that that NIST itself has a longstanding partnership with NASA for the development of new nanothermite and similar materials, and that Michael Zachariah is the coordinator of this partnership, and you just told me that he's a key player in the NIST affair.
Yes, absolutely. And he actually used to work for NIST, Zachariah did. And I believe he reported to Sumerjian back then. Ended up becoming this world's leading expert on nanothermite. And we recently had a FOIA response return that shows a long list of papers that aren't available publicly on the development of nanothermites. And Zachariah's name is just coming up everywhere. He works now at the University of Maryland College Park and used to work for the University of Minnesota as well. And he's trained a lot of the people who now are the most expert at these kind of high-tech explosives. But the paper goes on to say that NIST actually was testing with Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory these nanothermite materials as early as 1999. We do have evidence that they were testing these materials at NIST. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory was, as early as 1999, and probably earlier than that, I would expect. So, again, that all of these things lead to the question, why, how could they possibly not even consider that these materials and could have caused the unexplained fires at the World Trade Center? The reason why they could explain it is because nanothermites are explosive. They're also incendiary materials, which means energetic materials, which means that they don't require oxygen. They can be buried underneath the pile under 3 inches of dust. You can pour water all over them. You know, the chemical suppressant that was used at the World Trade Center wouldn't have much of any effect on them. They would burn, you know, if they were ignited by, for example, molten metal coming in contact with other molten metal or in some other way ignited. So NIST not even considering these materials, with knowing that, you know, all of their lead scientists had such connections to them, is, as you said, absurd.
It's certainly a textbook example of guilty demeanor. And isn't it true, Kevin, that in arson investigations, they're always supposed to check for thermite? It's a standard procedure to do that, isn't it?
That's right. There's a standard, which apparently the National Standard Institute of Standards and Technology doesn't tend to follow. The one standard they don't follow is the National Fire Protection Agency's NFPA's standard 921 for fire investigation, which is what they were doing with their NIST investigation. They were investigating essentially arson or fire in a structure. And that standard, the NFPA 921, calls for the testing of residues for thermite or other pyrotechnic material residues. It requires that testing, or at least, if not the testing, a stated justification why it wasn't done. And NIST didn't do either of those things. They openly admit they didn't do either of those things. And that's inexcusable, especially considering all the other evidence that we're now seeing. And I think that they absolutely will have to make a justification why they didn't test for these materials, why, you know, these materials, in their view, couldn't have been an explanation for the fires and for the molten metal and for the explosions. I think it's just going to be, ultimately, it's going to be too much for them to ignore.
I would think so. And it's certainly odd that in any other situation where a building is destroyed, apparently by a fire of some kind, there's always the presumption that whoever's got the insurance policy on that building needs to be looked into. I mean, this is just, you know, just standard operating procedure. And here at the World Trade Center, we have this guy who buys the whole complex on a 100-year lease and puts down a minuscule fraction of what he's going to have to pay as his down payment, takes out a massive insurance policy for terrorism, and then tries to collect double indemnity and ends up walking off with $4.5 billion in the insurance, a few more billion in some related thing, and now he's asking for another $11 billion. I'm talking, of course, about the landlord, Larry Silverstein. This is far more suspicious than would normally be the case in a situation where a building is destroyed, and yet, despite this apparent, real massive set of suspicious circumstances centering around Silverstein, if nothing else, there's absolutely no hint of any kind of investigation of arson for profit or anything like that. Not only in the courts and in by NIST and so on, but also by the media. The media has completely ignored all of that, and the New York Times, which knows very well that Silverstein has a highly dubious reputation in New York, has not come near this, nor has anybody else. It's inexplicable.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, as far as the investigation from NIST, it's very much like the 9/11 Commission investigation. It only occurred at all because certain people demanded it, and I'm talking about the families of the victims of 9/11, essentially insisting that these investigations occur, and both of them starting a year more after the events of 9/11. So, as you said, the connections to Larry Silverstein are just, you know, I think compelling is an understatement. The simple fact that we had three buildings collapse from fire all in the same day in the same place, and no such thing has ever happened before, all of that leading to a reason for us to invade the most strategically important lands for the production of oil and natural gas. The absurdity grows to at an exponential rate as people look at this evidence and this official story. If they look at it in light of day instead of using kind of assumptions that, you know, and unconscious kind of excuses, as we've heard from major media sources over the years, if they look at it in the light of day, they really can't come up with any explanation other than the fact that essentially some sort of government agencies had to be involved in the events of 9/11. I mean, if there's just no other way that all of this could have happened. And that's the basic difference, in my view, between the official story and the alternative hypotheses, is that with the alternative stories, there are many, of course, but all of them basically state that some government agencies of some sort, and very probably U.S. government agencies, were involved in the events of 9/11. So as far as the World Trade Center goes, you know, that leads to the investigations being so poorly done that some of them not being done, the National Transportation Safety Board investigations of planes that crashed didn't occur at all, as far as I understand.
Right. Yeah, Aidan Monahan has been filing FOIA requests and getting ridiculous stonewalling answers from the government. He's actually going to be on my show this coming Monday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time over on the other network, GCN. That's amazing, isn't it? They didn't have any evidence whatsoever to identify any of these four planes.
Absolutely. And Aidan, by the way, is a great researcher, and he's helping me with FOIAs on the nanothermites as well.
Well, hey, I'm sure happy that we have talented researchers at work on this. I'm not the world's best scientific researcher, I'll admit, but I can talk with them on the radio. That's what we're doing today. This is Kevin Barrett here on Truth Jihad Radio. I'm talking with Kevin Ryan, one of the most important scientists looking into what really happened on 9/11. And we will be back for another hour of talk. We've barely scratched the surface of the great work that Kevin Ryan has done. And we'll keep on scratching in the next hour. So hang in there. We'll be right back.